Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is special guest host Tamar Avishai.
Hi.
I'm excited to have you on. Could you tell the people out there a little bit about your background and where they might have heard you before?
Sure. I produce and host a show that's called The Lonely Palette, and it's a podcast that aims to make art history more accessible, more fun, for the masses.
Tamar and I met at an academic conference on podcasting, if you can imagine such a thing existing.
I think there are going to be a lot more soon enough.
I was familiar with your podcast. I was very excited to see you there. And I thought, wow, I could have you on to discuss this book, thinking this would be obviously in your wheelhouse. And it turns out you had not read From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Bazley Frankweiler, right?
I had not. And actually, much like normal school, I was racing to finish it in time for this. But I loved it. I loved it. And everybody that I told that I was doing this, they love it. And, oh, you're doing that? It's like I was stumbling over the title and they would fill it in for me. So that's a good sign.
Mara and I share a background. I also have a degree in art history. In my real life, not my podcast life, I work at an art museum. Both of us know a bit about the art world. We'll get into how credible we found this book from that standpoint. The Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Bazley Frankweiler is kind of on the low end age-wise of books we do on the show. Typically, we do show books that people read in high school. This is more a book that you might have read in middle school or grade school. It was a Newbery winner in 1968. It was written in 1967. And I guess that's probably why you didn't read it, because I keep forgetting that people were not born in the 60s like I was. So,
although, to be honest, I'm surprised that I haven't. There aren't that many young adult books about art museums, just like there aren't many movies about art museums. And so, we're kind of expected to have seen all of them, if only just to point out how wrong they are. And so I was actually really pleasantly surprised by how much this book got right. Maybe not about what it thought it was getting right, but I think to anybody who knows the field.
This book was written by E.L. Konigsberg. This was her second book. She submitted two books at once, and both books got on the Newbery list that year. And I can't imagine having such a fantastic start to one's writing career. Hmm. Konigsberg is an interesting person. I don't know if you read about her life at all.
No, that was the one thing I didn't actually research. So please tell me all about her.
She got a degree in chemistry at Carnegie Mellon. But like a lot of women of her era, she ended up being a housewife, even though she was highly educated. Mm-hmm. And so she was living the suburban housewife life with a bunch of kids. And she decided to try her hand at writing some children's books. Like the heroes of this book, she was living in Connecticut. And the story goes that she was at the Met with her kids and they saw a single piece of popcorn on a chair that was behind a velvet rope. And the boy asked, how did that popcorn get there? And that's what gave her the idea for this book.
Oh, that's so great.
I think most people out there have read the book, and those of you who haven't don't want it spoiled for you, but it is the story. It's the story of two suburban kids, Claudia and Jamie Kincaid, living in Greenwich, Connecticut in the mid-60s. Claudia has decided that she needs to run away from home for reasons that are not terribly clear.
Claudia knew that she could never pull off the old-fashioned kind of running away. That is, running away in the heat of anger with a knapsack on her pack. She didn't like discomfort. Even picnics were untidy and inconvenient. All those insects and the sun melting the icing on the cupcakes. Therefore, she decided that her leaving home would not be just running from somewhere, but would be running to somewhere. Claudia knew that she could never pull off the old-fashioned kind of running away. That is, running away in the heat of anger with a knapsack on her back. She didn't like discomfort. Even picnics were untidy and inconvenient. All those insects and the sun melting the icing on the cupcakes. Therefore, she decided that her leaving home would not be just running from somewhere, but would be running to somewhere.
That was something that I noticed, that you never really do understand why she runs away. And I kept waiting for the reveal, you know, not that something terrible had been happening to her at home, but just, you know, what was she really running from that she felt like the Met and kind of all of this adventure and all of this secrecy was going to give her. And because, you know, I so appreciate books that are really written from the point of view of the child, even though it's being narrated by this eccentric, you know, octogenarian, but I do love kind of getting that viewpoint from the kids, but honestly, I was thinking about their parents the entire time.
Well, that's one of the things that I actually find utterly charming about this book is how callous Claudia and Jamie are. They're in this for their own adventures, and we never really get to see what is going on back at home.
Yeah, maybe that says more about me, honestly, than the Kincaid kids, but I'll let that go.
Well, in any case, Claudia decides she needs to run away from home because she feels unappreciated at home. And mm-hmm. she decides that she's going to run away to spend her time in exile living in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. She has three younger brothers. She brings along the middle of those brothers, Jamie, mostly because he's got the most money. Although the two of them do become very close as the book goes along. They have adventures getting to the museum. They have adventures at the museum, avoiding the security and finding places to sleep at night and finding ways to subsist off the fat of the land. and eventually they become obsessed with the story. Well, at least Claudia becomes obsessed with the appearance of a small statue of an angel that is rumored to possibly have been done by Michelangelo, but nobody is quite sure. Mm-hmm. She decides she's going to figure out this statue's provenance without having any particular knowledge of art history or of the scientific methods of authentication. She and Jamie go and research this at the public library, and they send a letter to the museum staff, who send a very polite letter back to her.
It was so polite. I was really touched by how lovely that note back from the museum staff was. I mean, you would imagine, especially if there are questions of authentication, like people, you know, they must get stuff all the time from people who want to solve the mystery. So I like that added touch.
When I was in grad school, my internship was at the Museum of Fine Arts in the prints, drawings, and photographs department. Oh. And I was given the job of answering all these inquiries that came in. And some of them were as crazy as Claudia's. It was a good experience for me because I had to, on the fly, write a one-page research paper back to people about a work in the collection. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine it was some intern, if they had interns in those days, doing this. Claudia decides that before they go home, they're going to travel to the home of the titular Frankweiler. Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler is an eccentric octogenarian who had a Manhattan apartment that has closed down and has gone to live reclusively in her mansion in Connecticut. and she was the one who put the statue up for auction. When Claudia and Jamie show up at her house, Mrs. Frankweiler knows who they are immediately and tells them that they have to leave and go back home. But first, she will allow Claudia and Jamie to search through her crazy mixed-up files to find the answer to the puzzle. Now, we'll leave it there for the three people out there who haven't read this book. They can read it and find out what happens at the end.
Well, three now, as of 20 minutes ago, it was four. So I'm very glad to know the mystery.
I read this book, or I had this book read to me in fourth grade, I think it was, and I remember the class being absolutely enraptured. And I read the book several times over the years. I was a big museum goer as a kid. I did not like art museums, strangely enough. For someone who grew up to work in an art museum, I was much more fond of science museums. And I thought that if I could run away to New York City, I would have hidden out in the Natural History Museum.
I mean, science museums are meant for kids. You know, they're meant to take very complicated ideas and turn them into play, you know, turn them into ways of discovery, so that kids stay interested. And art museums never claim to do that. You know, there are some opportunities in museums to speak to kids, but they're really rare. And for me, I loved art museums as a kid because I knew it wasn't for me, you know, because I knew that I had to be quiet. And I mean, maybe that says what kind of a kid I was, but, you know, following rules, I was kind of like Claudia, you know, where I wanted to just be in the quiet and the high ceilings and the smell of the wood, you know, that just felt really, really sophisticated and mature and, you know, not as loud and full of carpeting as a science museum is. You know, I loved kind of the squeaky, polished floors of an art museum.
And especially in the mid-60s, art museums really did not go out of their way to make themselves knowable to sort of a general audience. I remember when I first moved to Boston, the MFA still had the same installation of Greek art that it had had since, I think, 1957 or something like that. And it was just case after case of attic figure vases with tiny little typewritten cards. I mean, they were actually typewritten, and no explanation given to what you were seeing or why it was important. And I kind of loved that too. I kind of loved the fact that it was like you were thrown into this world, and it was up to you to make of it what you would.
Yeah. No, I don't think people like that anymore, which is, you know, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. Like, it does encourage museums to be as, you know, as accessible as they can, but they still need to be, like, on brand. Like, they still need to have a little bit of that kind of sophistication and mystery that, you know, if you don't do a little bit of reading, you're not going to appreciate the object that you're looking at. And, you know, museum educators are always up in arms trying to figure out how to solve that problem. While I think a lot of curators, you know, it's what attracted them. Like, they liked the power of knowledge that isn't necessarily the most accessible to the general public.
The thing that occurs to me as I read this book through now is how many of the set pieces take place in displays and parts of the museum that are no longer famously they Claudia and Jamie bathe in the Fountain of the Muses, which is no longer at the Met. The bed they sleep in has been dismantled and put to storage. At one point they say their prayers in a chapel that is also no longer on display.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, one of the first books I did for this podcast was Catcher in the Rye. And there's a segment in there where Holden Caulfield talks about how the thing he loves about museums is the way that they are always the same. And he talks about a display of Eskimo and I'm going to use the word Eskimo because that's what he uses, not even though it's a term that's no longer used. And the thing that's ironic about that is that display in the Natural History Museum is no longer there. And museums are actually not set in time. They're constantly changing and constantly being reinstalled. But I think that people would like them to stay the way that they were the time that they first came there.
Yeah.
There is something to that, that idea that you go there when you're a child and you wish it would still be there.
Yeah.
But if I went to the Natural History Museum, the dinosaurs would all still be dragging their tails on the ground if they had not reinstalled everything.
They've built a few additions to the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. And I grew up in Boston, and my mom's an artist, and she used to take me. They have this this tradition every year called Art in Bloom, where they have local florists come in and pick a painting and have this beautiful display in front of the painting. And it was really special. Like, my mom would take me, and then we would go to Art in Bloom, and then we would get sushi, like, you know, my once a year sushi dinner. And I remember actually that my favorite paintings were in just a gallery that just doesn't exist anymore. I think everything's just been moved around, and it had this beautiful green bed and a sculpture of a dog, like a very sleek black sculpture of a dog. And there was something about the bed and the dog and the paintings and the flowers that, you know, and the quiet and then the sushi that just, you know, was to me, you know, as a 10-year-old, that was like the most sophisticated and elegant way to spend a day. And I'm at the MFA a couple times a month. I mean, I'm there a lot now, and nothing feels like that felt.
Let's talk a little bit about Claudia, because you said that you were a lot like Claudia when you were a child. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, I wasn't a straight A student, and I wasn't correcting everyone's grammar. You know, I mean, I wasn't kind of as fussy as she is, but I did love the power of the space. You know, like I felt like there was something really, I love the way that she describes, you know, what it's like to fall asleep in a museum. I think that, you know, that would actually be like my dream, to stay overnight at a museum, because something really changes in the quality of the space when you're there after hours. You know, even if it's just a night that the museum is open late and there just aren't a lot of people. And so you kind of go from gallery to gallery, and so many depend on natural light now. So you feel very different because so much of the light you expect to come from the sun. And to walk around at night just feels, I don't know. Like I don't know if I could articulate it. You know, just something about the vastness of the space and the quality of the air. You know, I love the idea that this is where somebody goes to find herself, to feel more sophisticated, to feel more adult.
I like what you're saying there about the finding herself. It's mostly Claudia's story, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jamie is there for the ride, but Claudia is learning something about herself. And what she's learning is she needs to have a secret, is what Mrs. Frankweiler says. She goes looking for adventure, and it's telling that she goes looking for adventure in a museum. Mm-hmm. Who thinks of museums as spots of personal adventure? But it's in the beauty of the space. It's in the search for better knowledge of of what she's looking at. She starts by telling Jamie that they're going to learn everything there is to know about everything in the museum.
Yeah, that actually, I circled that every time that came up, where she struck me as somebody who would do really, like, I expect her to drop out of an art history PhD someday. Like, that's who Claudia felt like to me, because she talks about wanting to know everything about everything and realizing that you can't, you know, there's no way to know every, you know, all the pertinent information about every object and every movement. And so she settles on, okay, well, I'll just learn everything about Michelangelo. And as she's kind of making these compromises, you know, she sicks Jamie on looking at the pictures while she looks at the text. And she, I love this, like she kind of looks over at some pictures and he's like, hey, this is my turf. And she's like, well, you know, I'm resting my eyes a little bit from the text. I need to see the pictures again. And then she, you know, kind of further, the best moment for me in the whole book was when she wants to hug the angel. And she says, you know, you can learn something about, when you hug someone, you learn something else about them. And that is something that every art historian realizes after too much time in the field, that they miss the art, you know, that they wish that they could touch the art again and have that kind of connection to it. Because the, you know, the further you almost distance yourself from the object with text, that's kind of what an academic degree is. And I love the idea that she approaches it for the right reason and also recognizes the limitations for the right reason. And I really appreciated that about Claudia, because she comes to this really important revelation about herself, which I think is really universal. And that's what's great about young adult books is kind of the lesson that you can take away from it. But there's a real authenticity to the way that she does that through art history that also feels really authentic.
Similar to what you said about text distancing ourselves from the art, museums distance people from art too.
Oh, yeah.
In that we preserve the object kind of fetishistically. Mm-hmm. The kind of interaction you have with the object is highly mitigated by security, by conservation issues, by lighting, by the installation, especially when it comes to material culture such as the bed that they sleep in. You can't sleep in the bed. No one gets to sit on the furniture that's on display. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I like about this book is it's that fantasy of being allowed to do that. The fantasy of being able to just use these objects the way that they were designed to be used.
Yeah. And you realize that a velvet rope really can't keep anybody, you know, anybody from anything. We, you know, psychologically, this barrier that the velvet rope says that you can't touch something. I love actually that backstory about the piece of popcorn, because it's like we think that our, you know, that popcorn can't touch a chair that's sitting, you know, that's meant to be displayed in a museum. And of course it can, you know, it's just an object. And we tell ourselves and we're told for so long and from such a young age that you can't touch the art. And what if you just do, you know, what if you just touch it? What if you just get into bed and the guards are gone? And, you know, I liked the juxtaposition of, you know, these kids who run away to an art museum, but they realize that they have to eat and they have to do laundry. And in that way, what a really impractical place a museum is for anything mundane, you know, for daily living. It's a terribly impractical place to run away to, because, you know, there's a rarefied sense to a museum space that it's like dirty underwear doesn't exist at a museum.
You talk about them eating, and one of the things that I was charmed to remember reading it through this time is they go eat over at Horn and Hardart, which is an automat. I don't know when automats went out of business finally in New York, but it made me think about all the things in this book that are a glimpse into mid-60s life, from Connecticut suburbs to taking trains into New York, and the fact that people can just kind of wander around the place and there is no security. And there, now, I mean, part of that has to do with the fact that these are two white kids from the suburbs, who are coming from a certain amount of privilege. It's charming that Jamie and Claudia have to figure out how they're going to eat and live, but we're never really afraid for them. Mm-hmm. Considering this is, after all, a story about children running away.
Yeah.
I don't think it could be written today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these books end up being such great relics of the time that they were written in, not just, of course, not just because of the plot, but of all of the little details that, a writer in the 60s would have, that would have been her reality. And so that's what's folded in.
There's two major relationships in this book. There's the relationship between Claudia and Jamie, which grows into a highly collaborative,
a complementary partnership.
Right, a complementary partnership between the two of them that allows them to see and admire the aspects of their personality that they couldn't when they were in just a domestic space. They develop a new appreciation for the skills that each brings to the table. Mm-hmm. It's, I think, a very smart book about the relationships between an older sibling and a younger sibling and the way that those things fall out. The other major relationship of the book is between Claudia and Mrs. Frankweiler.
I think you should learn, of course, and some days you must learn a great deal. But you should also have days when you allow what is already in you to swell up inside of you until it touches everything. And you can feel it inside of you. If you never take time out to let that happen, then you accumulate facts and they begin to rattle around inside of you. You can make noise with them, but never really feel anything with them. It's hollow.
This is what, to me, makes this book soar into a different level, other than just being sort of hijinks off in the museum. You rarely get to see this kind of story of a young girl looking to a much older, successful woman who imparts life lessons to her. Maybe today you see it more, but in the 60s, no. Frankweiler herself is this kind of, I don't know how you describe her. She's this world traveler, chemist. She does her own, conservation and materials analysis at her home.
With her mixed up filing cabinet that only she can understand. Well, of course, you find out that she's, may I spoil?
Okay. You may spoil, don't you?
You could have read the book by now, so since you started this. When you find out that she's writing to her lawyer to put the kids into her will, and that's kind of what the whole book has been leading to. I love the idea, again, that you can get closer to the art and bypass the art market, which is another piece of the book that is very, it's briefly and kind of subtly alluded to why she let the sculpture go for such, for such a paltry amount for what a sculpture like that could be worth. And also, she has all this documentation to back it up, and that's what she's leaving the kids. And I liked the way that she talked about, and the way that Claudia so completely understood each other, that it's more, the value of having a secret and the value of keeping that mystery so buoyant, but also how that gets lost in the art market when an object suddenly becomes this subject for debate, that you lose that kind of magic and that kind of aura that comes from the authenticity of an object and knowing that it's authentic before that goes into question. And it actually, timing-wise, the fact that this Leonardo da Vinci painting has just gone, has just been sold for $400 million. I was just doing a little bit of kind of Googling about the articles that came up about it, and exactly what Mrs. Frankweiler is afraid would happen if it came forward that this is, this is an authentic Michelangelo and it's going to the museum, where people would start debating it, and that kind of accuracy is so difficult to pin down, and it just ruins the object. And the same thing is happening right now about this Leonardo da Vinci that just sold at Christie's, where, you have Martin Kemp, this preeminent Leonardo da Vinci scholar saying that it's looks like it's authentic, and you have Jerry Saltz pushing back and saying, no, it looks absolutely dead. I don't believe it. And, you know, what is getting lost? What kind of aura is getting shattered in that back and forth debate? Like, what mystery and what secret is kind of evaporating in the face of facts? That's exactly what Claudia and Mrs. Frankweiler know to protect together.
The general public gets really fascinated by these stories of new discoveries of work or new works on the market. And people have this idea that art has an absolute value somehow, mm-hmm. that experts get together and they decide what that value is. And people also are very trusting to think that experts are able to authenticate with certainty works. You know, it's very rare that you can, I mean, it's actually impossible to positively assert the authenticity of a work. You can perhaps with microscopy looking at the marble of a work, say that, oh, this was quarried from somewhere in Sweden and not from somewhere in Italy, mm-hmm. therefore it can't be Michelangelo. People have a really strange idea about what art historians do. I think people still have the idea that it's all connoisseurship, that people are going to just look at the painting and say, oh yes, obviously you can see right mm-hmm. here by this passage that this has to be, you know, Michelangelo or whatever, and that kind of thing. Nobody does that anymore.
Yeah.
You'd mentioned early on that you thought that there were many things that this book got right, and I was wondering what else you might think this book gets right about art or museums. And what does it get wrong?
Oh, well, I guess what I feel like it got right was what I'd already talked about the, you know, kind of Claudia's, less about the museum itself and more about what I felt like Claudia's kind of art journey as an art history student, is something that really, really resonated with me. And actually why I left academia in art history. I felt like in that way, she and I were kind of the same kin. God, in terms of what it gets wrong. I don't know. What do you think?
Things have changed as far as security goes in museums. I don't think anyone could actually hide from a guard by standing on toilets in the stalls. That seems to me like the kind of a plot point that someone would come up with who was just trying, like Konigsberg was trying to figure the way out of a problem. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, even in the mid-60s, there would be night watchmen,
yeah.
and there would have been some video surveillance.
I would imagine that bathing in that fountain would have not felt very clean afterwards. I kept like thinking that I was waiting for them to describe the chlorine smell, and it never came. So that was a convenient plot point, I thought. There are a lot of times where people use settings to make a point, right? You know, it's like to explain the kind of character that Claudia is, then putting her in an art museum does some of the work for you. And people have associations with art museums and with the kind of, you know, a kid who wants to go to an art museum is a kid who's trying to be old beyond her years. You know, she's trying to reach for something that feels very grown up. And so it does a great job of establishing her as a character, but then it also does a really beautiful job of talking about what that museum space can feel like. And I was almost a little bit disappointed that there was a mystery, because I was enjoying so much just the description of being a runaway and deciding that, you know, you want to be taken seriously, and so you're going to run away to the Met. And what could be a more mature, you know, your parents can't be mad at you. Like, it's the Met, you know, look at how adult that decision was. And that when it pushed towards the mystery to be solved, you know, I was like, okay, I was along for the ride. But there is something, like, the book would be enough for me if it really was just exploring that popcorn, you know, that piece of popcorn the entire time. And what does it mean to be a human being trying to make a home out of a museum? Because that's impossible. It's not a space that is of us. And that's the point. You know, you go to a museum and you're kind of swimming in aura everywhere you go. And you have to be quiet and you have to show due respect to these objects that are so old and will be around so much longer than you. And so you have to treat them with respect and care. And for a kid, you know, like I keep going back to, you know, God, they put their music cases inside the sarcophagus and, you know, and they get up onto the bed and they hide underneath it and they can tell based on how dusty it is, you know, if it's been cleaned recently. And so they want to go under the, you know, into the cleaner ones so that they won't get caught. And it's just such a merging of what it is to be a kid and what it is to be a human being, actually. And then the, you know, just the powerful elegance and kind of unlivability of a museum that I was just really charmed by throughout.
I like what you said about this maybe not needing to have a mystery. I think part of what motivates the author's desire for a mystery is trying to give a narrative shape to the story. Mm-hmm. Because typical stories about children in crisis, and Claudia and Jamie aren't on the surface in crisis, although Claudia has run away. Typical stories about running away from home take the form of something gets learned,
yeah,
that motivates the return to the stasis. You know, motivates a return back to home, but with changed characters in some way. And this is not a book in which people have epiphanies, or at least not an epiphany about Claudia realizing something about her parents that she never realized before, or even having some sort of a close call where she and Jamie are in danger and realizing what, you know, domesticity means as far as safety is concerned, mm-hmm, or something like that. Because this is not going to be a book that is going to moralize that way, it's interesting to me that Claudia is left wanting to give meaning to her adventure. You know, mm-hmm, if in some ways, you know, she left without a good motivation, she's realizing that as she has to go home. She wants to go home feeling she's accomplished.
Yeah, with a story and with, right, you know, the kind of fame that's really going to change her life.
Right.
Yeah.
And what's ironic about that, of course, is she ends up with something that she is unable to tell anyone, mm-hmm, by the terms of the will, mm-hmm, that she can't. So, but that's enough for her. It's enough for her to feel changed.
Yeah.
And that is an interesting narrative shape to the novel.
Yeah. And because of that, you know, whether or not any of the, you know, how accurate all of the authenticity pieces of it, I mean, that's totally beside the point. I think that there's enough, you know, not only is the museum used as a setting to help really explain this character, but it's used really well. I feel like the parts of the museum that speak to her and the part of this mystery that she internalizes is, to me, as somebody who has experience in art history in the museum world, just felt really accurate. And that was a piece of it that I was struck by, that, you know, that the author is able to both create this narrative arc for her and use the setting in a proper way. It's a young adult book, so it's not, you know, this isn't like some of the other, like, I don't think that it's been dissected a lot. And it's cool to be able to do it. You know, if we've kind of hit the wall, that's fine. But I'm grateful to have this book in my life right now. I don't feel like young adult books give their kids this much, I don't know, this much agency. Like I was reading the, you know, some of the decisions, you know, how Jamie was so good with money and how he would, you know, cheat his friend to, like, that was actually, like, really smart of him. Like, he thought a couple moves ahead all the time. And I don't think of 9-year-old boys being empowered with that kind of intellect in, you know, in books that I read today. I mean, I granted, I haven't read that many young adult books in the last little while. Yeah, it was a really beautifully written story. It felt like it was a book that was written also with the parents in mind who might be reading it out loud and speaking across the, you know, across the divide that way to both parents and kids.
When you mentioned Jamie cheating, it again reminds me of how grateful I am that this book is so happy to be cheerfully amoral. And scandalous. The kids are involved in trespassing, in possibly damaging priceless artifacts, and it's presented in a beautiful, wonderful way. And just the heartlessness of them running away and leaving their parents to wonder where they were for
like about a week and a half.
Yeah.
And you don't even meet the parents at the end. You know, you just kind of see them through the window. They're you know, attractive. They're probably my age. And you meet home through one of their brothers who comes running out and is just like, I mean, I'm not sure if I read it right, that now he was their responsibility. Like, that's kind of their punishment. Did I read that right? I don't know.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so it's like already... As glad as their parents are to have them home, you know, they're walking right into their punishment. But it really isn't about the home that they're leaving at all, obviously. I mean, they are privileged kids. They're privileged enough to run away. They've never been hungry, and this is the first time they've ever experienced a world without that kind of structure. And all she needed really was a secret. And, you know, that speaks to a certain kind of privilege, but it's also very universal. You know, somebody her age needs a secret to feel like she's an adult.
There's the other line that I love from the book that I think is very beautiful is when Jamie says, "You're right, New York is great. Nobody pays any attention to you here," or something like that. I think that's, there's a time in most people's lives where you either move to a big city or you strike out on your own in a big city, and the indifference of the world is
so thrilling. Yeah, you know, nobody's breathing down your neck.
It's liberating in this case. Yeah. The other thing I just want to say, because I was talking about earlier about security at museums and how I kind of doubted things at the Met here. I have to admit, when I was in college, and this was in 1989, I went to the British Museum with someone whose name I will not repeat on this podcast, and you'll find out why in a second. And we walked up to the Rosetta Stone, which at the time was presented in open air with a small railing that kind of encircled the Rosetta Stone at a distance of about 2 feet. And he looked at me and he said, "John, I'm going to touch the Rosetta Stone." And I said, "You can't touch the Rosetta Stone." And he leaned over and he stroked the Rosetta Stone.
Good for him.
And every Londoner looking on in that room stared in absolute horror and there were absolutely no consequences for him whatsoever.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it is stone, and it survived this long. And I know people take really good care of it, but it's so funny when objects cross the line from you know, kind of wet paint to like belonging to the ages, and what that means for the way that it's treated. I mean, I know we want to keep these objects, you know, as in as good a condition as possible for as long as possible, clearly. But they've done pretty well. You know, ancient objects are pretty sturdy. And then you also start to get into objects that have never meant to, you know, I mean, you go to the Tate Modern and... If it's still like this, you go to the Tate Modern and Duchamp's urinal is under glass, which I think it's hilarious. I mean, he would be laughing his head off at us that we have decided that this is an object that is so valuable. You know, he went to a plumbing manufacturer and he bought a urinal and he signed it and he put it in a museum, and, you know, history and the ages took care of the rest. But the idea that you can't touch this, that we can damage this urinal, you know, that it has to be under glass. Or, God, I mean, I saw the Mona Lisa for the first time a couple of years ago. And not only could I barely get to it, but it's impossible to even see it, really. You know, it's also behind glass. And, you know, we've made the decision that these objects are so, so precious. And have kind of stripped them of any ability to defend themselves, almost. Like they're overly protected. I mean, who hasn't wanted to like lick a Monet? Come on. I would never do it. But it is a very powerful thing to touch an artwork. And I think of that actually whenever I look at conservators and you know, preparers. That they're the ones who are the ones, you know, actually hanging it up in the museum space. Like, how cool that their job is to actually, you know, hold this Van Gogh as they're, you know, having instructions yelled at them for how high it should be. Like, they're, you know, boots on the ground doing something that none of us are allowed to do.
Thanks to my co-host, Tamar Avishai. Her podcast is called The Lonely Palette and is available where you find podcasts. Follow her on Twitter at Lonely Palette and on Instagram, The Lonely Palette. The book excerpts were read this time by Moises Kahulian. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write the podcast at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join the Facebook page and keep up on the reading, because everything will be on the final.